This is Audible.
Ashet Audio presents Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela. Written by Nelson Mandela. Read by Michael Boatman. With a special introduction by Kofi Annan. Featuring Nelson Mandela's presidential oath of office, an afterword by Sharon Gelman, an interview with Long Walk to Freedom collaborator Richard Stengel at the end of the program. Includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of a foreword written by President Bill Clinton.
People often ask me what difference one person can make in the face of injustice, conflict, poverty, and disease. I answer by citing the courage, tenacity, dignity, and magnanimity of Nelson Mandela. I cite his lifelong struggle against apartheid and his steadfast refusal to compromise his beliefs during long years of incarceration. I cite his inspired leadership upon his release in the peaceful transition to a genuine multiracial, multi-partied democracy firmly founded on a constitution protecting fundamental human rights. I cite his efforts as President of the Republic of South Africa to create the political, economic, and social conditions needed to bring Africa the peace and prosperity it needs and deserves. Above all, I cite his ready willingness to embrace and reconcile with those who persecuted him the most, and the grace with which he stuck to his promise to serve only one presidential term of office. His contribution did not end there. To this day, Madiba remains probably the single most admired, most respected international figure in the entire world. He continues to inspire millions of people and several generations throughout the globe by continuing to fight for reconciliation before recrimination, healing before bitterness, peace before conflict, by fighting for health, for education, for the right of every child to have a better start in life, by spelling out the right and duty of not only South Africa, but of all Africa to take charge of its own future and fate. As he said in one of his many eloquent speeches, and I quote, "Africa has long traversed past a mindset that seeks to heap all blame on the past and on others," end of quote. The only adequate way in which we can truly express our gratitude for Madiba's contribution is for every one of us to work every day to follow his example. If just one small part of what he has sought to achieve for his fellow human beings is translated into reality, if we live up to just one fraction of the standards he has set for himself, then Africa and the world will be a far, far better place.
Africa, magu benjalo, magu benjalo, kute kubenguna pagate, kute kubenguna pagate.
I dedicate this book to my six children, Madiba and Makaziwe, my first daughter, who are now deceased, and to Makato, Makaziwe, Zenani, and Zinzi, whose support and love I treasure. To my 21 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren who give me great pleasure, and to all my comrades, friends, and fellow South Africans whom I serve, and whose courage, determination, and patriotism remain my source of inspiration. Acknowledgements. As listeners will discover, This book has a long history. I began writing it clandestinely in 1974 during my imprisonment on Robben Island. Without the tireless labor of my old comrades, Walter Sisulu and Ahmed Kathrada, for reviving my memories, it is doubtful the manuscript would have been completed. The copy of the manuscript which I kept with me was discovered by the authorities and confiscated. However, in addition to their unique calligraphic skills, my co-prisoners Mac Maharaj and Isu Chiba had ensured that the original manuscript safely reached its destination. I resumed work on it after my release from prison in 1990. Since my release, my schedule has been crowded with numerous duties and responsibilities, which have left me little free time for writing. Fortunately, I have had the assistance of dedicated colleagues, friends, and professionals who have helped me complete my work at last, and to whom I would like to express my appreciation. I am deeply grateful to Richard Stengel, who collaborated with me in the creation of this book, providing invaluable assistance in editing and revising the first parts and in the writing of the latter parts. I recall with fondness our early morning walks in the Transkei and the many hours of interviews at Shell House in Johannesburg and my home in Houghton. A special tribute is owed to Mary Pfaff, who assisted Richard in his work. I have also benefited from the advice and support of Fatima Mir, Peter Magubani, Nadine Gordimer, and Ezekiel Mpaflele. I want to thank especially my comrade Ahmed Kathrada for the long hours spent revising, correcting, and giving accuracy to the story. Many thanks to my ANC office staff, who patiently dealt with the logistics of the making of this book, but in particular to Barbara Masekela, for her efficient coordination. Likewise, Iqbal Mir has devoted many hours to watching over the business aspects of the book. I am grateful to my editor, William Phillips of Little Brown, who has guided this project from early 1990 on and edited the text, and to his colleagues Jordan Pavlin, Steve Schneider, Mike Mattel, and Donna Peterson. I would also like to thank Professor Gail Gerhardt for her factual review of the manuscript. Part 1. A Country Childhood. Chapter 1. Apart from life, a strong constitution, and an abiding connection to the Tembu royal house, the only thing my father bestowed upon me at birth was a name, Rolihlahla. In Xhosa, Rolihlahla literally means pulling the branch of a tree, but its colloquial meaning more accurately would be troublemaker. I do not believe that names are destiny, or that my father somehow divined my future, but in later years, friends and relatives would ascribe to my birth name the many storms I have both caused and weathered. My more familiar English or Christian name was not given to me until my first day of school, but I am getting ahead of myself. I was born on the 18th of July, 1918, at Mvezo, a tiny village on the banks of the Mbashi River, in the district of Umtata, the capital of the Transkei. The year of my birth marked the end of the Great War, the outbreak of an influenza epidemic that killed millions throughout the world, and the visit of a delegation of the African National Congress to the Versailles Peace Conference to voice the grievances of the African people of South Africa. Mvezo, however, was a place apart, a tiny precinct removed from the world of great events, where life was lived much as it had been for hundreds of years. The Transkei is 800 miles east of Cape Town, 550 miles south of Johannesburg, and lies between the Kei River and the Natal border, between the rugged Drakensberg Mountains to the north and the blue waters of the Indian Ocean to the east. It is a beautiful country of rolling hills, fertile valleys, and a thousand rivers and streams, which keep the landscape green even in winter. The Transkei used to be one of the largest territorial divisions within South Africa, covering an area the size of Switzerland, with a population of about 3.5 million Xhosas, and a tiny minority of Basutos and Whites. It is home to the Tembu people, who are part of the Xhosa nation, of which I am a member. My father, Gadla Henry Mpakaniswa, was a chief by both blood and custom. He was confirmed as chief of Mvezo by the king of the Tembu tribe, but under British rule, his selection had to be ratified by the government, which in Mvezo took the form of the local magistrate. As a government-appointed chief, he was eligible for a stipend as well as a portion of the fees the government levied on the community for vaccination of livestock and communal grazing land. Although the role of chief was a venerable and esteemed one, it had, even 75 years ago, become debased by the control of an unsympathetic white government. The Tembu tribe reaches back for 20 generations to King Zwide. According to tradition, the Tembu people lived in the foothills of the Drakensberg Mountains and migrated toward the coast in the 16th century, where they were incorporated into the Xhosa nation. The Xhosa are part of the Nguni people, who have lived, hunted, and fished in the rich and temperate southeastern region of South Africa, between the great interior plateau to the north and the Indian Ocean to the south, since at least the 11th century. The Nguni can be divided into a northern group, the Zulu and the Swazi people, and a southern group, which is made up of Amabaka, Amabomyana, Amagaleka, Amamfengu, Amampondomisa, Amampondo, Abesuto, and Abetembu, and together they comprise the Xhosa nation. The Xhosa are a proud and patrilineal people, with an expressive and euphonious language, and an abiding belief in the importance of laws, education, and courtesy. Xhosa society was a balanced and harmonious social order in which every individual knew his or her place. Each Xhosa belongs to a clan that traces its descent back to a specific forefather. I am a member of the Madiba clan, named after a Tembu chief who ruled in the Transkei in the 18th century. I am often addressed as Madiba, my clan name, a term of respect. Ngun Benkuka, one of the greatest monarchs who united the Tembu tribe, died in 1832. As was the custom, he had wives from the principal royal houses, the Great House, from which the heir is selected, the Right Hand House, and the Ithiba, a minor house that is referred to by some as the Left Hand House. It was the task of the sons of the Ithiba, or Left Hand House, to settle royal disputes. Mtikrakra, the eldest son of the Great House, succeeded Ngubenkuka, and amongst his sons were Ngangalizwe and Matanzima. Sabata, who ruled the Tembu from 1954, was the grandson of Ngangalizwe and a senior to Kaiser Dalewanga, better known as K.D. Matanzima, the former chief minister of the Transkei, my nephew by law and custom, who was a descendant of Matanzima. The eldest son of the Ikliba house was Simakade, whose younger brother was Mandela, my grandfather. Although over the decades there have been many stories that I was in the line of succession to the Tembu throne, the simple genealogy I have just outlined exposes those tales as a myth. Although I was a member of the royal household, I was not among the privileged few who were trained for rule. Instead, as a descendant of the Ikliba house, I was groomed, like my father before me, to counsel the rulers of the tribe. My father was a tall, dark-skinned man with a straight and stately posture, which I like to think I inherited. He had a tuft of white hair just above his forehead, and as a boy I would take white ash and rub it into my hair in imitation of him. My father had a stern manner and did not spare the rod when disciplining his children. He could be exceedingly stubborn, another trait that may unfortunately have been passed down from father to son. My father has sometimes been referred to as the Prime Minister of Tembuland during the reigns of Dalinjebo, the father of Sabata, who ruled in the early 1900s, and that of his son, Jongintaba, who succeeded him. That is a misnomer, in that no such title existed, but the role he played was not so different from what the designation implies. As a respected and valued counselor to both kings, he accompanied them on their travels and was usually to be found by their sides during important meetings with government officials. He was an acknowledged custodian of Xhosa history, and it was partially for that reason that he was valued as an advisor. My own interest in history had early roots and was encouraged by my father. Although my father could neither read nor write, he was reputed to be an excellent orator who captivated his audiences by entertaining them as well as teaching them. In later years, I discovered that my father was not only an advisor to kings, but a king-maker. After the untimely death of Jongilizwe in the 1920s, his son Sabata, the infant of the great wife, was too young to ascend to the throne. A dispute arose as to which of Dalinjebu's three most senior sons from other mothers, Jongintaba, Tabulamanzi, and Melitafa, should be selected to succeed him. My father was consulted and recommended Jongintaba on the grounds that he was the best educated. Jongintaba, he argued, would not only be a fine custodian of the crown, but an excellent mentor to the young prince. My father and a few other influential chiefs had the great respect for education that is often present in those who are uneducated. The recommendation was controversial, for Jongintaba's mother was from a lesser house. But my father's choice was ultimately accepted by both the Tembus and the British government. In time, Jongintaba would return the favor in a way that my father could not then imagine. All told, my father had four wives, the third of whom, my mother, Nosikeni Fani, the daughter of Nkidama from the Amampemvu clan of the Xhosa, belonged to the right-hand house. Each of these wives, the great wife, the right-hand wife, my mother, the left-hand wife, and the wife of Ikadi, or support house, had her own kraal. A kraal was a homestead and usually included a simple fenced-in enclosure for animals, fields for growing crops, and one or more thatched huts. The kraals of my father's wives were separated by many miles, and he commuted among them. In these travels, my father sired 13 children in all, 4 boys and 9 girls. I am the eldest child of the right-hand house, and the youngest of my father's 4 sons. I have 3 sisters, Baliwe, who was the oldest girl, Notanthu, and Makutswana. Although the eldest of my father's sons was Mhlawa, my father's heir as chief was Dalikili, the son of the great house, who died in the early 1930s. All of his sons, with the exception of myself, are now deceased, and each was my senior not only in age, but in status. When I was not much more than a newborn child, my father was involved in a dispute that deprived him of his chieftainship at Mvezo and revealed a strain in his character I believe he passed on to his son. I maintain that nurture, rather than nature, is the primary molder of personality. But my father possessed a proud rebelliousness, a stubborn sense of fairness that I recognize in myself. As a chief, or head man, as it was often known among the whites, my father was compelled to account for his stewardship not only to the Tembu king, but to the local magistrate. One day, one of my father's subjects lodged a complaint against him involving an ox that had strayed from its owner. The magistrate accordingly sent a message ordering my father to appear before him. When my father received the summons, he sent back the following reply, "I will not come. I am still girding for battle." One did not defy magistrates in those days. Such behavior would be regarded as the height of insolence, and in this case, it was. My father's response bespoke his belief that the magistrate had no legitimate power over him. When it came to tribal matters, he was guided not by the laws of the King of England, but by Tembu custom. This defiance was not a fit of pique, but a matter of principle. He was asserting his traditional prerogative as a chief, and was challenging the authority of the magistrate. When the magistrate received my father's response, he promptly charged him with insubordination. There was no inquiry or investigation. That was reserved for white civil servants. The magistrate simply deposed my father, thus ending the Mandela family chieftainship. I was unaware of these events at the time, but I was not unaffected. My father, who was a wealthy nobleman by the standards of his time, lost both his fortune and his title. He was deprived of most of his herd and land, and the revenue that came with them. Because of our straitened circumstances, my mother moved to Klunu, a slightly larger village north of Mvezo, where she would have the support of friends and relations. We lived in a less grand style in Klunu, but it was in that village near Umtata that I spent the happiest years of my boyhood, and whence I trace my earliest memories. Chapter 2. The village of Klunu was situated in a narrow, grassy valley, crisscrossed by clear streams and overlooked by green hills. It consisted of no more than a few hundred people who lived in huts, which were beehive-shaped structures of mud walls, with a wooden pole in the center holding up a peaked grass roof. The floor was made of crushed ant heap, the hard dome of excavated earth above an ant colony, and was kept smooth by smearing it regularly with fresh cow dung. The smoke from the hearth escaped through the roof, and the only opening was a low doorway one had to stoop to walk through. The huts were generally grouped together in a residential area that was some distance away from the maize fields. There were no roads, only paths through the grass worn away by barefooted boys and women. The women and children of the village wore blankets dyed in ochre. Only the few Christians in the village wore Western-style clothing. Cattle, sheep, goats, and horses grazed together in common pastures. The land around Klunu was mostly treeless, except for a cluster of poplars on a hill overlooking the village. The land itself was owned by the state. With very few exceptions, Africans at the time did not enjoy private title to land in South Africa, but were tenants, paying rent annually to the government. In the area, there were two small primary schools, a general store, and a dipping tank to rid the cattle of ticks and diseases. Maize, what we called mealies and people in the West call corn, sorghum, beans, and pumpkins formed the largest portion of our diet. Not because of any inherent preference for these foods, but because the people could not afford anything richer. The wealthier families in our village supplemented their diets with tea, coffee, and sugar. But for most people in Klunu, these were exotic luxuries far beyond their means. The water used for farming, cooking, and washing had to be fetched in buckets from streams and springs. This was women's work, and indeed, Klunu was a village of women and children. Most of the men spent the greater part of the year working on remote farms or in the mines along the reef, the great ridge of gold-bearing rock and shale that forms the southern boundary of Johannesburg. They returned perhaps twice a year, mainly to plow their fields. The hoeing, weeding, and harvesting were left to the women and children. Few, if any, of the people in the village knew how to read or write, and the concept of education was still a foreign one to many. My mother presided over three huts at Klunu, which, as I remember, were always filled with the babies and children of my relations. In fact, I hardly recall any occasion as a child when I was alone. In African culture, the sons and daughters of one's aunts or uncles are considered brothers and sisters, not cousins. We do not make the same distinctions among relations practiced by whites. We have no half-brothers or half-sisters. My mother's sister is my mother. My uncle's son is my brother. My brother's child is my son, my daughter. Of my mother's three huts, one was used for cooking, one for sleeping, and one for storage. In the hut in which we slept, there was no furniture in the Western sense. We slept on mats and sat on the ground. I did not discover pillows until I went to Hekezweni. My mother cooked food in a three-legged iron pot over an open fire in the center of the hut or outside. Everything we ate, we grew and made ourselves. My mother planted and harvested her own mealies. Mealies were harvested from the field when they were hard and dry. They were stored in sacks or pits dug in the ground. When preparing the mealies, the women used different methods. They could ground the kernels between two stones to make bread, or boil the mealies first, producing umputulo, mealy flour eaten with sour milk, or umkusho, samp, sometimes plain or mixed with beans. Unlike mealies, which were sometimes in short supply, milk from our cows and goats was always plentiful. From an early age, I spent most of my free time in the veld, playing and fighting with the other boys of the village. A boy who remained at home, tied to his mother's apron strings, was regarded as a sissy. At night, I shared my food and blanket with these same boys. I was no more than 5 when I became a herd boy, looking after sheep and calves in the fields. I discovered the almost mystical attachment that the Xhosa have for cattle, not only as a source of food and wealth, but as a blessing from God and a source of happiness. It was in the fields that I learned how to knock birds out of the sky with a slingshot, to gather wild honey and fruits and edible roots, to drink warm, sweet milk straight from the udder of a cow, to swim in the clear, cold streams, and to catch fish with twine and sharpened bits of wire. I learned to stick fight, essential knowledge to any rural African boy, and became adept at its various techniques, parrying blows, feinting in one direction and striking in another, breaking away from an opponent with quick footwork. From these days I date my love of the veld, of open spaces, the simple beauties of nature, the clean line of the horizon. As boys, we were mostly left to our own devices. We played with toys we made ourselves. We molded animals and birds out of clay. We made ox-drawn sleighs out of tree branches. Nature was our playground. The hills above Trunu were dotted with large, smooth rocks which we transformed into our own roller coaster. We sat on flat stones and slid down the face of the large rocks. We did this until our backsides were so sore we could hardly sit down. I learned to ride by sitting atop weaned calves. After being thrown to the ground several times, one got the hang of it. I learned my lesson one day from an unruly donkey. We had been taking turns climbing up and down its back, and when my chance came, I jumped on, and the donkey bolted into a nearby thorn bush. It bent its head, trying to unseat me, which it did, but not before the thorns had pricked and scratched my face, embarrassing me in front of my friends. Like the people of the East, Africans have a highly developed sense of dignity, or what the Chinese call face. I had lost face among my friends. Even though it was a donkey that unseated me, I learned that to humiliate another person is to make him suffer an unnecessarily cruel fate. Even as a boy, I defeated my opponents without dishonoring them. Usually the boys played among themselves, but we sometimes allowed our sisters to join us. Boys and girls would play games like Ndize, hide and seek, and Ithikwa, touch and run. But the game I most enjoyed playing with the girls was what we called Keta, or choose the one you like. This was not so much an organized game, but a spur-of-the-moment sport that took place when we accosted a group of girls our own age and demanded that each select the boy she loved. Our rules dictated that the girl's choice be respected, and once she had chosen her favorite, she was free to continue on her journey, escorted by the lucky boy she loved. But the girls were nimble-witted, far cleverer than we doltish lads, and would often confer among themselves and choose one boy, usually the plainest fellow, and then tease him all the way home. The most popular game for boys was Tinti, and like most boys' games, it was a youthful approximation of war. Two sticks, used as targets, would be driven firmly into the ground in an upright position about 100 feet apart. The goal of the game was for each team to hurl sticks at the opposing target and knock it down. We each defended our own target and attempted to prevent the other side from retrieving the sticks that had been thrown over. As we grew older, we organized matches against boys from neighboring villages, and those who distinguished themselves in these fraternal battles were greatly admired, as generals who achieve great victories in war are justly celebrated. After games such as these, I would return to my mother's kraal, where she was preparing supper. Whereas my father once told stories of historic battles and heroic Xhosa warriors, my mother would enchant us with Xhosa legends and fables that had come down from numberless generations. These tales stimulated my childish imagination and usually contained some moral lesson. I recall one story my mother told us about a traveler who was approached by an old woman with terrible cataracts on her eyes. The woman asked the traveler for help, and the man averted his eyes. Then another man came along and was approached by the old woman. She asked him to clean her eyes, and even though he found the task unpleasant, he did as she asked. Then, miraculously, the scales fell from the old woman's eyes, and she became young and beautiful. The man married her and became wealthy and prosperous. It is a simple tale, but its message is an enduring one. Virtue and generosity will be rewarded in ways that one cannot know. Like all Xhosa children, I acquired knowledge mainly through observation. We were meant to learn through imitation and emulation, not through questions. When I first visited the homes of whites, I was often dumbfounded by the number and nature of questions that children asked of their parents, and their parents' unfailing willingness to answer them. In my household, questions were considered a nuisance. Adults imparted information as they considered necessary. My life, and that of most Xhosas at the time, was shaped by custom, ritual, and taboo. This was the alpha and omega of our existence, and went unquestioned. Men followed the path laid out for them by their fathers. Women led the same lives as their mothers had before them. Without being told, I soon assimilated the elaborate rules that governed the relations between men and women. I discovered that a man may not enter a house where a woman has recently given birth, and that a newly married woman would not enter the kraal of her new home without elaborate ceremony. I also learned that to neglect one's ancestors would bring ill fortune and failure in life. If you dishonored your ancestors in some fashion, the only way to atone for that lapse was to consult with a traditional healer or tribal elder who communicated with the ancestors and conveyed profound apologies. All of these beliefs seemed perfectly natural to me. I came across few whites as a boy at Xhunu. The local magistrate, of course, was white, as was the nearest shopkeeper. Occasionally, white travelers or policemen passed through our area. These whites appeared as grand as gods to me, and I was aware that they were to be treated with a mixture of fear and respect. but their role in my life was a distant one, and I thought little, if at all, about the white man in general, or relations between my own people and these curious and remote figures. The only rivalry between different clans or tribes in our small world at Tunu was that between the Xhosas and the Amamfengu, a small number of whom lived in our village. Amamfengu arrived on the Eastern Cape after fleeing from Shaka Zulu's armies in a period known as the Amafane, the great wave of battles and migrations between 1820 and 1840, set in motion by the rise of Shaka and the Zulu state, during which the Zulu warrior sought to conquer and then unite all the tribes under military rule. Amamfengu, who were not originally Xhosa speakers, were refugees from Amafane, and were forced to do jobs that no other African would do. They worked on white farms and in white businesses, something that was looked down upon by the more established Xhosa tribes. But Amamfengu were an industrious people, and because of their contact with Europeans, they were often more educated and Western than other Africans. When I was a boy, Amamfengu were the most advanced section of the community and furnished our clergymen, policemen, teachers, clerks, and interpreters. They were also among the first to become Christians, to build better houses, and to use scientific methods of agriculture. And they were wealthier than their Xhosa compatriots. They confirmed the missionary's axiom that to be Christian was to be civilized, and to be civilized was to be Christian. There still existed some hostility toward Amamfengu, but in retrospect, I would attribute this more to jealousy than tribal animosity. This local form of tribalism that I observed as a boy was relatively harmless. At that stage, I did not witness nor even suspect the violent tribal rivalries that would subsequently be promoted by the white rulers of South Africa. My father did not subscribe to local prejudice toward Amamfengu and befriended two Amamfengu brothers, George and Ben Mbekela. The brothers were an exception in Tunu. They were educated and Christian. George, the older of the two, was a retired teacher, and Ben was a police sergeant. Despite the proselytizing of the Mbekela brothers, my father remained aloof from Christianity, and instead reserved his own faith for the great spirit of the Xhosas, Kamata, the god of his fathers. My father was an unofficial priest and presided over ritual slaughtering of goats and calves, and officiated at local traditional rites concerning planting, harvest, birth, marriage, initiation ceremonies, and funerals. He did not need to be ordained, for the traditional religion of the Xhosas is characterized by a cosmic wholeness, so that there is little distinction between the sacred and the secular, between the natural and the supernatural. While the faith of the Mbekela brothers did not rub off on my father, it did inspire my mother, who became a Christian. In fact, Fanny was literally her Christian name, for she had been given it in church. It was due to the influence of the Mbekela brothers that I myself was baptized into the Methodist or Wesleyan Church, as it was then known, and sent to school. The brothers would often see me playing or minding sheep and come over to talk to me. One day, George Mbekela paid a visit to my mother. "Your son is a clever young fellow," he said. "He should go to school." My mother remained silent. No one in my family had ever attended school, and my mother was unprepared for Mbekela's suggestion. But she did relay it to my father, who, despite, or perhaps because of, his own lack of education, immediately decided that his youngest son should go to school. The schoolhouse consisted of a single room with a Western-style roof on the other side of the hill from Tunu. I was 7 years old, and on the day before I was to begin, my father took me aside and told me that I must be dressed properly for school. Until that time, I, like all the other boys in Tunu, had worn only a blanket, which was wrapped around one shoulder and pinned at the waist. My father took a pair of his trousers and cut them at the knee. He told me to put them on, which I did, and they were roughly the correct length, although the waist was far too large. My father then took a piece of string and cinched the trousers at the waist. I must have been a comical sight, but I have never owned a suit I was prouder to wear than my father's cut-off pants. On the first day of school, my teacher, Miss Ndingani, gave each of us an English name and said that from thenceforth that was the name we would answer to in school. This was the custom among Africans in those days and was undoubtedly due to the British bias of our education. The education I received was a British education in which British ideas, British culture, British institutions were automatically assumed to be superior. There was no such thing as African culture. Africans of my generation, and even today, generally have both an English and an African name. Whites were either unable or unwilling to pronounce an African name and considered it uncivilized to have one. That day, Miss Ndingani told me that my new name was Nelson. Why she bestowed this particular name upon me, I have no idea. Perhaps it had something to do with the great British sea captain, Lord Nelson. But that would be only a guess. Chapter 3. One night, when I was 9 years old, I was aware of a commotion in the household. My father, who took turns visiting his wives and usually came to us for perhaps 1 week a month, had arrived. But it was not at his accustomed time, for he was not scheduled to be with us for another few days. I found him in my mother's hut, lying on his back on the floor, in the midst of what seemed like an endless fit of coughing. Even to my young eyes, it was clear that my father was not long for this world. He was ill with some type of lung disease, but it was not diagnosed, as my father had never visited a doctor. He remained in the hut for several days, without moving or speaking, and then one night he took a turn for the worse. My mother and my father's youngest wife, Noda Imani, who had come to stay with us, were looking after him, and late that night he called for Noda Imani. "Bring me my tobacco," he told her. My mother and Noda Imani conferred and decided that it was unwise that he have tobacco in his current state. But he persisted in calling for it, and eventually Noda Imani filled his pipe, lit it, and then handed it to him. My father smoked and became calm. He continued smoking for perhaps an hour, and then, his pipe still lit, he died. I do not remember experiencing great grief so much as feeling cut adrift. Although my mother was the center of my existence, I defined myself through my father. My father's passing changed my whole life in a way that I did not suspect at the time. After a brief period of mourning, my mother informed me that I would be leaving Gunu. I did not ask her why or where I was going. I packed the few things that I possessed, and early one morning we set out on a journey westward to my new residence. I mourned less for my father than for the world I was leaving behind. Gunu was all that I knew, and I loved it in the unconditional way that a child loves his first home. Before we disappeared behind the hills, I turned and looked for what I imagined was the last time at my village. I could see the simple huts and the people going about their chores, the stream where I had splashed and played with the other boys, the maize fields and green pastures where the herds and flocks were lazily grazing. I imagined my friends out hunting for small birds, drinking the sweet milk from the cow's udder, cavorting in the pond at the end of the stream. Above all else, my eyes rested on the three simple huts where I had enjoyed my mother's love and protection. It was these three huts that I associated with all my happiness, with life itself, and I rued the fact that I had not kissed each of them before I left. I could not imagine that the future I was walking toward could compare in any way to the past that I was leaving behind. We traveled by foot and in silence until the sun was sinking slowly toward the horizon. But the silence of the heart between mother and child is not a lonely one. My mother and I never talked very much, but we did not need to. I never doubted her love or questioned her support. It was an exhausting journey, along rocky dirt roads, up and down hills, past numerous villages, but we did not pause. Late in the afternoon, at the bottom of a shallow valley surrounded by trees, we came upon a village at the center of which was a large and gracious home that so far exceeded anything that I had ever seen that all I could do was marvel at it. The buildings consisted of two rectangular houses and seven stately rondavals, superior huts, all washed in white lime, dazzling even in the light of the setting sun. There was a large front garden and a maize field bordered by rounded peach trees. An even more spacious garden spread out in back, which boasted apple trees, a vegetable garden, a strip of flowers, and a patch of wattles. Nearby was a white stucco church. In the shade of two gum trees that graced the doorway of the front of the main house sat a group of about 20 tribal elders. Encircling the property, contentedly grazing on the rich land, was a herd of at least 50 cattle and perhaps 500 sheep. Everything was beautifully tended, and it was a vision of wealth and order beyond my imagination. This was the great place, Mkhizweni, the provisional capital of Tembuland, the royal residence of Chief Jongintaba Dalinjebo, acting regent of the Tembu people. As I contemplated all this grandeur, an enormous motor car rumbled through the western gate, and the men sitting in the shade immediately arose. They doffed their hats and then jumped to their feet, shouting, "Bayete a Jongintaba! Hail Jongintaba!" the traditional salute of the Xhosas for their chief. Out of the motor car, I learned later that this majestic vehicle was a Ford V8, stepped a short, thick-set man wearing a smart suit. I could see that he had the confidence and bearing of a man who was used to the exercise of authority. His name suited him, for Jongintaba literally means one who looks at the mountain, and he was a man with a sturdy presence toward whom all eyes gazed. He had a dark complexion and an intelligent face, and he casually shook hands with each of the men beneath the tree, men who, as I later discovered, comprised the highest Tembu court of justice. This was the regent who was to become my guardian and benefactor for the next decade. In that moment of beholding Jongintaba and his court, I felt like a sapling pulled root and branch from the earth and flung into the center of a stream whose strong current I could not resist. I felt a sense of awe mixed with bewilderment. Until then, I had had no thoughts of anything but my own pleasures, no higher ambition than to eat well and become a champion stick fighter. I had no thought of money or class or fame or power. Suddenly, a new world opened before me. Children from poor homes often find themselves beguiled by a host of new temptations when suddenly confronted by great wealth. I was no exception. I felt many of my established beliefs and loyalties begin to ebb away. The slender foundation built by my parents began to shake. In that instant, I saw that life might hold more for me than being a champion stick fighter. I learned later that, in the wake of my father's death, Jongintaba had offered to become my guardian. He would treat me as he treated his other children, and I would have the same advantages as they. My mother had no choice. One did not turn down such an overture from the regent. She was satisfied that although she would miss me, I would have a more advantageous upbringing in the regent's care than in her own. The regent had not forgotten that it was due to my father's intervention that he had become acting paramount chief. my mother remained in Kizweni for a day or two before returning to Tkunu. Our parting was without fuss. She offered no sermons, no words of wisdom, no kisses. I suspect she did not want me to feel bereft at her departure, and so was matter of fact. I knew that my father had wanted me to be educated and prepared for a wide world, and I could not do that in Tkunu. Her tender look was all the affection and support I needed, and as she departed, she turned to me and said, "Brace yourself, my boy." Children are often the least sentimental of creatures, especially if they are absorbed in some new pleasure. Even as my dear mother and first friend was leaving, my head was swimming with the delights of my new home. How could I not be braced up? I was already wearing the handsome new outfit purchased for me by my guardian. I was quickly caught up in the daily life of Mkixweni. A child adapts rapidly, or not at all, and I had taken to the great place as though I had been raised there. To me, it was a magical kingdom. Everything was delightful. The chores that were tedious in Tkunu became an adventure in Mkixweni. When I was not in school, I was a plowboy, a wagon guide, a shepherd. I rode horses and shot birds with slingshots and found boys to joust with, and some nights I danced the evening away to the beautiful singing and clapping of Tembu maidens. Although I missed Tkunu and my mother, I was completely absorbed in my new world. I attended a one-room school next door to the palace and studied English, Xhosa, history, and geography. We read Chambers' English Reader and did our lessons on black slates. Our teachers, Mr. Fadana and later Mr. Gikwa, took a special interest in me. I did well in school, not so much through cleverness as through doggedness. My own self-discipline was reinforced by my aunt Fitatiwe, who lived in the great place and scrutinized my homework every night. Kizweni was a mission station of the Methodist Church, and far more up-to-date and westernized than Tkunu. People dressed in modern clothes. The men wore suits, and the women affected the severe Protestant style of the missionaries, thick long skirts and high-necked blouses, with a blanket draped over the shoulder and a scarf wound elegantly around the head. If the world of Mkixweni revolved around the regent, my smaller world revolved around his two children. Justice, the elder, was his only son and heir to the great place, and Nomafu was the regent's daughter. I lived with them and was treated exactly as they were. We ate the same food, wore the same clothes, performed the same chores. We were later joined by Ngeko, the older brother to Sabata, the heir to the throne. The four of us formed a royal quartet. The regent and his wife, No England, brought me up as if I were their own child. They worried about me, guided me, and punished me, all in a spirit of loving fairness. Jongintaba was stern, but I never doubted his love. They called me by the pet name of Tatunkulu, which means grandpa, because they said when I was very serious, I looked like an old man. Justice was 4 years older than I, and became my first hero after my father. I looked up to him in every way. He was already at Clarkbury, a boarding school about 60 miles distant. Tall, handsome, and muscular, he was a fine sportsman, excelling in track and field, cricket, rugby, and soccer. Cheerful and outgoing, he was a natural performer who enchanted audiences with his singing and transfixed them with his ballroom dancing. He had a bevy of female admirers, but also a coterie of critics who considered him a dandy and a playboy. Justice and I became the best of friends, though we were opposites in many ways. He was extroverted, I was introverted. He was light-hearted, I was serious. Things came easily to him, I had to drill myself. To me, he was everything a young man should be, and everything I longed to be. Though we were treated alike, our destinies were different. Justice would inherit one of the most powerful chieftainships of the Tembu tribe, while I would inherit whatever the regent, in his generosity, decided to give me. Every day I was in and out of the regent's house, doing errands. Of the chores I did for the regent, the one I enjoyed most was pressing his suits, a job in which I took great pride. He owned half a dozen Western suits, and I spent many an hour carefully making the crease in his trousers. His palace, as it were, consisted of two large Western-style houses with tin roofs. In those days, very few Africans had Western houses, and they were considered a mark of great wealth. Six rondavels stood in a semicircle around the main house. They had wooden floorboards, something I had never seen before. The regent and the queen slept in the right-hand rondavel, the queen's sister in the center one, and the left-hand hut served as a pantry. Under the floor of the queen's sister's hut was a beehive, and we would sometimes take up a floorboard or two and feast on its honey. Shortly after I moved to Kizweni, the regent and his wife moved to the Utlande, middle house, which automatically became the great house. There were three small rondavels near it, one for the regent's mother, one for visitors, and one shared by Justice and myself. The two principles that governed my life at Nkexweni were chieftaincy and the church. These two doctrines existed in uneasy harmony, although I did not then see them as antagonistic. For me, Christianity was not so much a system of beliefs as it was the powerful creed of a single man, Reverend Matiolo. For me, his powerful presence embodied all that was alluring in Christianity. He was as popular and beloved as the regent, and the fact that he was the regent's superior in spiritual matters made a strong impression on me. But the church was as concerned with this world as the next. I saw that virtually all of the achievements of Africans seemed to have come through the missionary work of the church. The mission schools trained the clerks, the interpreters, and the policemen, who at the time represented the height of African aspirations. Reverend Matiolo was a stout man in his mid-50s, with a deep and potent voice that lent itself to both preaching and singing. When he preached at the simple church at the western end of Nkexweni, the hall was always brimming with people. The hall rang with the hosannas of the faithful, while the women knelt at his feet to beg for salvation. The first tale I heard about him when I arrived at the great place was that the Reverend had chased away a dangerous ghost with only a Bible and a lantern as weapons. I saw neither implausibility nor contradiction in this story. The Methodism preached by Reverend Matiolo was of the fire and brimstone variety, seasoned with a bit of African animism. The Lord was wise and omnipotent, but he was also a vengeful God who let no bad deed go unpunished. At Kunu, the only time I had ever attended church was on the day that I was baptized. Religion was a ritual that I indulged in for my mother's sake and to which I attached no meaning. But at Nkexweni, religion was a part of the fabric of life, and I attended church each Sunday along with the regent and his wife. The regent took his religion very seriously. In fact, the only time that I was ever given a hiding by him was when I dodged a Sunday service to take part in a fight against boys from another village, a transgression I never committed again. That was not the only rebuke I received on account of my trespasses against the Reverend. One afternoon, I crept into Reverend Matiolo's garden and stole some maize, which I roasted and ate right there. A young girl saw me eating the corn in the garden and immediately reported my presence to the priest. The news quickly made the rounds and reached the regent's wife. That evening,